Israel, Messiah, Lazarus, Zion, and Man-Child. Now, all these characters have died. It says in Ecclesiastes, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. So if you take some of these scriptures to heart and slow down a bit, it's actually telling us a great deal. Let's do a little bit of a preamble. In this study, I hope to show you a little of the grandeur of what we are a part of. Our struggle down here for Yeshua, for Torah, for Zion, is much bigger than most can fathom. The struggle began before Adam. The Bible has some passages that mention things that happened before Adam's creation. Many people may be familiar with the fall of Lucifer or Satan before Adam, but there is mention of the fall of Zion and the annihilation of the house of Israel that just could not have happened in the history of the world after Adam. So what is going on? We may not have a full grasp of this drama, but hopefully you'll begin to appreciate how great it is. Perhaps we will gain a little perspective from our everyday battles as we ponder this greater picture. We will look at God's perspective of time. And that picture there is an artist's representation of the cherubim. And you can't see the faces there too well, but there's four cherubs. We'll talk about those later, four faces. And the wheels within wheels full of eyes. So we're going to have a look at time. And then we're going to look at some of the main actors in this drama. How they all died and will be raised from the dead. And as mentioned before, Adam, Israel, Messiah, Lazarus, Zion, and Man-Child. And we will look at these characters visually using the imagery of the tabernacle in order to see how these characters are related to one another and how they are related to the kingdom of God. And I want you to train your eyes on this. We're going to focus on some of these images quite a lot, especially this one here, the encampment of Israel in Numbers chapter 2. And this is related also to the cherubim, as I'll explain later. And there's actually a fifth cherub, and that is the one related to the tribe of Levi. And that is related to the tabernacle, which is related to us as the temple of the Holy Spirit. And this pyramid is a visual representation of it. And there are some Luciferic imitations of this. So the woman here is Zion. And the dragon, of course, is Satan, related to Leviathan. He's contesting right here at the apex of the pyramid. The fifth cherub. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's have a look at time, first of all. It says in Genesis, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Of course, in Hebrew, it's actually literally the heavens. There's multiple layers of administration, governmental administration, different office levels in the heavenly realm. There's different realms. And this word, Bereshit, in the beginning, literally means in the head, in the first. And it's related to the first day of the week, in a sense, because the first day of the week is called Yom Rishon, day first. Rishon and Reshit are related words from the root Rosh, meaning head or chief or first. So in Isaiah chapter 46, verse 10, we read, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Now this is quite an interesting verse, because it means that in order to understand the last days, the Yomim Achrim, and here the word for it, end is achrit, related to the word achrim, yamim achrim, last days. The last things are here contrasted with the things at the beginning. And if you remember the book of Genesis, we have a garden and we have the Tower of Babel, and we see those things mentioned in the book of Revelation. So in a way, we're heading back to the beginning. In Genesis 1:5 we read, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. V'yikra Elohim la'or yom v'lachoshek kara laila v'hi erev v'hi volcha yom achad. And this is a very interesting verse, because it doesn't say first day in the Hebrew. It says first day in the King James. I don't know what it says in the NASB or any of these different versions. But this says Yom Echad, and for someone that has learned Hebrew and knows the Hebrew days of the week, this stands out. So the normal word for first day would be Yom Rishon. Yom Rishon, Yom Shani, Yom Shlishi, Yom Revi, and so forth. So it stands out in the Hebrew that is, they haven't used that word. They use the normal words for the days of the week for every other day of creation, but not this one. So what is that saying? Okay, so there's the day one, and here we have, which is actually translated first day, but it's actually literally saying Yom Echad. It says, there was evening and morning, day one. So it's saying that it's not the first day. That's what it. Now, the second day is the day after Yom Echad. So that is, it's the second day. So then we have ordinal numbers after this day one, which is a cardinal number. Okay. So we'll go back to that, talk about that later. In Ecclesiastes 3:15, it says, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. In Hebrew, Ma shahaya kavahu, v'asher yihyo kavahaya, v'ha'alohim yabakesh et nerdaf. And this word, hath already been, kavah, is very interesting. One of the things that I learned from studying Hebrew, from reading the Torah, reading the prophets, is that no word is there without a reason. It's really from the mind of God, through man, which is really wonderful. And so if we read in Ezekiel, we read about this wonderful vision that the prophet had. Now it came to pass in the 13th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kiba, that the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Praise the Lord. Well, why does he mention the river Kiba? This is what I've understood from reading the prophets. Nothing is there without a reason. God is very, very tight with his words. He doesn't say anything without there being an important reason for it. The word kibar is the same word for hath already been in the previous slide. That which has been has already been, already. Kibar. So here's the same word, but here it's used as a name of a river. And it's mentioned in Ezekiel 1:1 and 3 and 3:15 and 23 and chapter 10. All the stuff about the cherubim. And so the river Kibar represents something that's happened already. He's having a prophetic vision of things that are pertain to the future, but they're actually touching on things that have already been. This is the connection that I've made by reading that. So in a sense, this river Kibar represents time. What has been has already happened. And that works. That marries into the very nature of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahweh, however people choose to say it. He was, he is, he will be, past, present, and future. Hayah, Hovei, Yihyeh. And all those letters are in the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yahweh. So Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh represents someone that's outside of time, not bounded by it. He was, he is, he will be. So he's the eternal. So he's Yahweh, Jehovah, or Lord. This is the word usually translated Lord in the Old Testament with the capital YYD. So he's the Lord of time. And notice there's four letters in his name related to the four cherubim. In Revelation 1:8 we read, I am the Alpha and Omega in Greek. And that's just the Aleph Tav in Hebrew, the first and last letters of the Hebrew alphabet. I am the Alpha and Omega, the Aleph Tav, the beginning and ending, saith the Lord, which is, Haya, and which was, Hovei, and which is to come, not Yavo, as in as some people sing, and that's the wrong word. It's actually Yihyeh, and that which is to come. It's not coming to a place, it's to do with time. It's future, which is to come. And so that the word Yihyeh means, it's related to time. The Almighty. So he actually, in this verse in Revelation, if we could read it in Hebrew, it's basically saying that Yahweh is related to that which was and is and will be. And so Yeshua, who is the Alpha and Omega, is saying that he's the Almighty. He's Yahweh. And some would have a problem with God being a man. But it's really encoded into the name Yahweh. And this is the wonderful thing, is that God can, or at least part of him, can be within a man. We know that with Adam. He breathed into him, into his nostrils, the neshama, the spirit. And indeed, that's Yeshua was filled with the spirit of counsel and the spirit of might and all these things. So Yahweh was within Yeshua. And Yeshua prayed for us that we would be one as he is one. Mm-hmm. But it's not so in that sense we are part of God. We are Elohim, we are gods, but not in the New Age sense of the word. Because the New Ages would say we're gods and we can do anything we like. Mm-hmm. But we're grafted into the vine. So we're only part of Elohim if we are abiding in him. And we are vessels for his spirit. So it's only as we come to an end of ourselves and let his life reign in us that we can be sort of nodes in the mind of God or limbs of his body. We can only be members or branches of the vine if we abide in him. In Revelation 4:8 we read again, and the four beasts had each of them six wings about him. And of course these are the cherubim that we read of in Ezekiel, with some differences in their descriptions. And they were, but this is in the New Testament in Revelation. And they were full of eyes within, and they rest not day and night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come." Now, God is outside of time, and He's telling us a lot in Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 1, the Hebrew calendar is intimated. He said there is, He created the sun, moon, and stars for days and seasons, and the word seasons is moed. But Genesis has got a lot to say about what happened before Adam. And this is expanded on in other scriptures, and I want to touch on just some of them briefly tonight. And the earth was without form and void, v'ha'aretz hayata tohu v'vohu, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, v'choshek al p'nei tahom, and the Spirit of God moved upon the water, the face of the waters, v'ruach Elohim merchefet al p'nei hamayim. This word, these words tohu v'vohu, are used elsewhere in scripture, and they talk about a world that is chaotic. But God is not the author of confusion. So what's happening? Well, let's have a look elsewhere. In Jeremiah chapter 4, the Lord is castigating Israel for their sins. And then when we get up to verse 22, he seems to, in verse 23 in particular, and onwards, he starts to talk about something that couldn't have happened in Israel's experience. So we read, "For my people is foolish, and they have not known me. They are sottish, children, stubborn, and they have none understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was tohu vavohu. It was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light." So, this is talking about something that happened in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, when it says the earth was tohu vavohu, the earth was formless and void, and darkness, choshek, was al p'nei tahom, was upon the face of the deep. And in the next verse we read, "I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens had fled." Now, if we read this as poetry, we're going to miss what he's saying. We need to slow down. If you're learning Hebrew, this is good. Slow down and actually take in what he's saying. Because what he's saying is that this is on an earth where there's no Adam. Because the word for man is ha'adam. "I beheld the earth, and the ra'iti v'hinayin ha'adam, v'kol of hashemayim nirdaf." So this is a time when there was no Adam. Now, during the flood, there was eight Adams. There were four males and four females, Noah and his three sons, and his wife and their wives, making eight people in total. Eight representing a new beginning. But this is a time when God had visited the earth with judgment, and there was no Adam. "I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at the presence of the Lord and by his fierce anger." So this is a time when the Lord had visited the earth with wrath. "For thus hath the Lord said, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end." If he had made a full end of everything, there wouldn't be an earth. So he actually desolated the earth. But he was about to replenish it. "V'ruach Elohim merchefet al p'nei hamayim, v'yemia Elohim yehi'or v'yehi'or." And the Spirit of God hovered upon the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. So the waters were already there. So when we're reading Genesis chapter 1 verse 2, it's telling us about a desolate earth that God is replenishing. He created the earth originally in the time past, but it had been desolate. And now we read in Jeremiah, how it was desolated and why. It was because of wickedness of Israel. But Israel didn't exist then, did it? Or did it? For this shall the earth mourn and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken it, I have purposed it, and will not repent, neither will I turn back from it. In Genesis chapter 1, there was evening and morning, erev v'bokher, and the first day, it's actually day one. It says God separated the light from the darkness. He separated between the light and the darkness. So the darkness was already there. And the darkness is related to rebellion. And so we see that for this reason the earth shall mourn and the heavens be black. So the reason the heavens are black, I'm just taking this literally, is because the whole heavens, what do women and men wear when they're mourning? Black. So the whole creation wears black. The sky didn't originally, before this happened, the sky wasn't black. This is a time before Adam, when the heavens were black. And the Lord is telling this to us because in the last days we're going to need to know. Maybe right now we don't. I'm just giving you some hints. But the last days are going to be quite out of this world. At some stage, we're going to see some stuff. Verse 29, the whole city shall flee for the noise of the horsemen and bowmen. They shall go into thickets and climb up upon rocks. Every city shall be forsaken and not a man dwell therein. It's talking about the past, but it's also talking about the future. He was, he is, and he will be. And when thou art spoilt, what wilt thou do? Though thou clothest thyself with crimson. God's talking to Zion. He's talking to Israel. But he's talking about something that happened in the past. Though thou deckest thee with ornaments of gold, though thou rentest thy face with painting, in vain shalt thou make thyself fair, thy lovers will despise thee, they will seek thy life. And Israel is always trying to gain the affection of nations. She's going a whoring after that affection when she should be searching for that affection from God himself. Now it gets interesting. Next verse. For I have heard a voice of a woman in travail, and the anguish as of her that bringeth forth her first child, the voice of the daughter of Zion that bewaileth herself, that spreadeth her hands, saying, woe is me now, for my soul is weary because of murderers. In the Song of Songs, we read about a woman that's being pursued by the groom, and she's not ready to meet him, and she gets beaten up in the streets. And we read about a woman in the wilderness in Revelation 12. We're going to look at that, and I put it to you that is the same woman. It's Zion. She has 12 stars about her head, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. So let's have a look about about Adam and the image of God. So God created man, Ha-Adam, in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. So women and men are part of Ha-Adam. The woman was taken from his side. So they're actually both part of the image of God. Zakar unakiva, male and female, bara atam, created he them. And the word zakar means male, and the word nakiva means female. The normal word for man, everyday word, is ish. And the word for woman or wife is isha. And if you rearrange these letters, you get Yah and fire, Esh. Those are those two words down the bottom of the screen, right there. So in any true marriage, you're going to have fire, and Yah is in the middle of it. He is the one that makes a true marriage work. And without him, we're really unequally yoked. And here's a picture of the holy place, and I'll put all these threads, we'll begin to put these threads together. Within the holy place there's a picture of male and female. There's a holy place there, it's that part. It's not where the Ark of the Covenant is. It's just where the showbread and the menorah are. And in the middle there's Yah, if you like. Bringing reconciliation between the two, if you like. So the table of showbread is related to the man, and the menorah is related to the woman. The man's the breadwinner, the woman is the light of the house. She lights the Sabbath candles. And
also Bernie, if you don't keep your eye straight.
That's right.
What's the altar of incense? What does it represent?
The altar of incense is prayer. The incense are prayers of the saints read in Revelation, and it's related to the nose and what was breathed into Adam through his nostrils was the neshama. So here we have a picture of, you could look at this as two trees. The lechem, the showbread, lechem panim. Lechem means bread, and a cognate of that is l'chaim, to life. So this is the tree of life. On the other side is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It has 22 almonds on it, the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. But it can't really have life in it of itself unless it's combined with the tree of life. What happened in the Garden of Eden was there was a crooked serpent, a crooked priest, that was getting Eve to disobey God in order that she may get the secret understanding of wisdom. And that's what people go after, secret wisdom and knowledge and deep mystical insights in the New Age movement and all sorts of religions. And but without having the Messiah, without having that connection to God, if we're disobeying his commandments, we're not going to get true wisdom. We're going to get death. Now, in Genesis 3:14-15, we read, "And the Lord God said unto the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly thou shalt go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life." And the word belly is Gihon, and it's the name of one of the four headwaters, the four rivers that came out of Eden. One of them was called Gihon. And God is saying, on your Gihon you shall go. And it just happens to be that that's the name of a spring that comes out of Jerusalem, perhaps hinting that there's a subterranean river underneath Jerusalem. When Yeshua returns, that river's going to be released. We know that there's going to be water that comes out of the temple and it's going to turn into a great river that goes into the Dead Sea.
That's where Rob Skeeter said.
And that river runs straight through the temple. And so that's where Satan's going to be, right there in the temple in the last days. And I'll, now in the next verse it says, "And I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." So we've seen that in Messiah Yeshua. We've seen it in ourselves. We're also coming, our seed lines come against the wicked. This world is really made up of only two groups of people, the righteous and the wicked. The seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. It's not for me to judge who's who. We're to go out and give the gospel and to teach people God's ways. But ultimately, there's only two groups of people. And God knows those that are his. We have the sheep and the goats, the wheat and the tares. There is a battleground on this earth between two seed lines. The seed of the wicked, the seed of the serpent, and the righteous, the seed of the woman. And we are told in Hebrews, we'll look at this soon, that we are from the heavenly Jerusalem, which relate to that woman. In Romans chapter 5, verse 14. I had to put something a little bit silly there because it's so serious. But thankfully, we're not in misery. There is a way out from death, and that's through the Son. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression, who is the figure of him that was to come. Now, if you read Leviticus 21, you'll find that priests can be contaminated by a corpse. They can be they're only agreed for their next of kin. So there's something about death and priests that doesn't mix. It shows us that death is inherently unclean, and we don't need to be rocket scientists to work that out. But God's trying to underline something. Sadly, priests couldn't touch dead bodies. Mm-hmm. We need if we are to overcome the power of death, we need a priesthood that's higher than Levi in order to deal with it. And so then we read, but not as the offence also is the free gift. For if through the offence of one many be dead, much more the grace of God and the gift of grace, which is by one man, Jesus Christ, hath abounded unto many. So, thankfully, there is a priesthood, and we read about the Melchizedek priesthood. Yeshua is both king and priest, Melchizedek, king of righteousness. And he's a priest of the order of Melchizedek through the power of an endless life, not through the offering of animals as a sacrifice, but through the offering of himself and his own body. So he's able to deal with death. And this is the death of the body. It's not the death of the spirit. If you read about the offerings in Leviticus, you'll read that they're for sin. They're only for intentional sin. So there's unforgivable sin, and that is what Satan, what the Pharisees were guilty of. That's the unwillingness to repent. And there's no forgiveness for that. So let's now have a look at Zion and how it's related to Israel. Here we have the Israelite encampment drawn visually, and it didn't quite look like this. This is drawn with the longer line here of Judah, and because when you take a census of all the numbers of these tribes, which were aligned in the east and in the north and the west and south, Judah's total of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun was almost twice as long as the others. So we have the form of a cross here. And at the centre, we have the tent of meeting. So related to each of the tribes is a banner. Judah is a lion. Dan is a serpent, by the way. But he's also related to the eagle. These, I'll show you later, are related to the zodiac. And the zodiac actually shows the 12 tribes of Israel. And it's actually been perverted, and it's related to the Hebrew calendar. So Ephraim is an ox, and it tells us that Joseph's an ox, and Ephraim's an ox, and Reuben is a man unstable as water, so he's related to the man, the cherub that's a man. So these are the four cherubim, the lion, the eagle, the ox, and the man. Dan, the eagle, is in the quadrant, is in the constellation of Scorpio, which has a man struggling with a serpent, with one foot on a serpent and another on a scorpion, and that's sometimes pictured as an eagle, that man that's struggling. He's struggling with a serpent nature, because Dan is about judgment. Now, wherever we have four in the Bible, we have connections. So four cherubim, four winds, four tribal encampments, four zodiac quadrants, four gospels, four species, and Jacob's four wives. And for the sake of time, I don't have time to get into that. Now, in Lamentations chapter 2, we read, How hath the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger, and cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel, and remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger? Now, when people read through Lamentations, they're of course taking this poetically, and they're just saying, well, he's just using a little bit of exaggeration, a bit of poetic license. I don't read the scriptures that way. The more I read the scriptures, the more I kind of zero in on details. For me, I find that extremely odd that he says, fallen from heaven to earth. And I think that God is trying to tell us a little bit more about Zion. And that Zion, when Lucifer fell, all of creation fell with him to some degree. And there was a judgment on the earth. It talks about Halal ben Shachar, or what we call Lucifer, son of the morning. So he was perfect in beauty. And here we have the beauty of Israel being cast down. He's also called Leviathan, Leviathan, or Levi dragon. So Lucifer is really related to Zion in some way, and he's related to the tribe of Levi. Can you remember that Korah and his rebellion and how the earth opened up? It sounds very similar to Lucifer's prospect. What happened is he fell in the past. This is how I understand it. Before Adam, he was of the order of the seraphs. He was the chief cherub that covereth. He was above the other cherubim, perhaps even above the throne where the seraphim are. In Isaiah 6 it says they sing holy, holy, holy. They are the burning ones. And when Israel sinned, God sent the seraphim, Nachashim, the fiery serpents, after the Israelites, and they bit them. And then he rose up. He gave them the bronze serpent that he raised up. We'll talk about that soon. But essentially, Satan was related to that order of cherub, the seraphs. And they're all to do with judgment and holiness. And unfortunately, he got lifted up by his pride, by his beauty. And not only did he fall, but he caused the Israel that is in the heavens to fall. So this is paradigm shifting stuff, in the sense that there's something about Israel in the past, and God is in the restoration. It's not just a restoration of stuff that happened after Adam. And I'm not saying that God's going to restore Lucifer and his minions. I'm not talking about that. But there is something that did fall, and we'll read about some other things that have happened that could not possibly have happened in this in our history now, if we take it literally. In Ezekiel 37:9, read about the valley of dry bones, and we read, "Then said he unto me, prophesy unto the wind, prophesy, son of man, and say to the wind, thus saith the Lord God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe upon these slain, that they may live." Now, we understand that God's going to put the house of Israel and the house of Judah together. And in chapters 36 and 37, we read about Israel and their coming together and joining with Judah. And the valley of dry bones represents the house of Israel. But this verse shows me something else as well. That it's not just talking about the house of Israel as we know it today, or the lost tribes. It's talking about something that happened in the past, and it can't have happened this time, this side of Adam. That Israel was slain. These didn't die. The word is not mut. They didn't die. They were slain. Okay. All right. So the word here for slain is some. But these have all been slaughtered. So the whole house of Israel was slaughtered, and I've never seen a time in history where that's happened. So this is actually referring to something that touches on something that happened before Adam. That's my only conclusion from that. And there's more evidence of this. Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones of the whole house of Israel, behold, they say our bones are dried and our hope is gone. We are cut off for our parts. So the Messiah is bringing us and bringing Israel back, but there's something more that's been going on. Revelation chapter 5, verse 6, let's read about Messiah. And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four beasts, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb, as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. And we'll find that those spirits are related to the seven churches, which is related to the menorah. So those seven eyes of the lamb are related to the menorah. In Zechariah 3:9, we read, "For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove iniquity in the land in one day." So there's another reference to a stone with seven eyes. And that's going to be important, because he's the capstone of an unfinished work. And that may sound, you may have some foreboding when I speak. I'm going to say it like this, and I say it with purpose. There, that capstone, as I understand it, is Yeshua, and it is his bride, it's the church. It says in Psalms 118, verse 22, "The stone which the builders refused has become the headstone of the corner." Even Ma'asu Habanim Hayata L'Rosh Pina, Rosh Pina, head of the corner. It's very interesting. The builders, because that's what the Freemasons like to refer themselves to. Yeshua refers to himself as the stone in Matthew 21 and Mark 12 and Luke 20. Freemasonry likes to think of themselves as builders. They want to build Zion and Solomon's temple while rejecting Yeshua. They want to install Lucifer as the all-seeing eye. Revelation 13:8, we read, "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." Here's the stuff that's happening before. It says in Genesis, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et, and it. Ha'aretz. And here we have the Aleph Tav, Alpha and Omega, but we also have a Vav, and that's the sixth letter related to man. So in a sense we have a picture here of Et, that's the Son of God, the Aleph Tav, and the Son of Man, and Yeshua is both. And he is between the heavens and the earth. And if we rearrange those letters, we get the word ot in Hebrew, meaning sign. And it says, regarding the Sabbath, it is a ot. Ba'ani uva'in b'nei Yisrael, ot hi le'olam, ki sheshet yamim asa Yahweh et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz, uva yom hashavi'i shabbat v'yenefash. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. So the sign is Yeshua himself, and he's intimately related to the Sabbath. And we've actually entered into the Sabbath. By the way, there's a PDF version of this I can give to people too, but keep making notes. But I can give you a PDF version. Now it says in 1 Corinthians, for Jews require a sign, an ot, and Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto Greeks foolishness, but unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, or Messiah, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Now it gets interesting. In John 3:14 we read, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up." And where was he lifted up? Between heaven and earth. Remember, Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. So that ve'et is between hashamayim, and you rearrange those letters and it's the word ot. It's the Son of God and the Son of Man. Sometimes the truth is right in front of us, but it is not dressed the way we like it, especially a naked snake on a pole. And I'm going to talk more about the snake and what it represents. It represents sin. They made this serpent, this bronze serpent on a pole. And anyone that was bitten by fiery serpents looked upon this. And this is a strange thing to be talking about. Why is the imagery of a serpent used? Well, first of all, it's related to sin. We know that. And the word for copper in Hebrew, nechoshet, is related to nechash. But and everything in the tabernacle that had copper and nechoshet, it has that idea of the nechash, the serpent, in its very name. So to deal with sin, you have to deal with serpent. And we have to deal with serpent-like nature within ourselves. Now, the priesthood had dealt with sin. And they dealt with copper or bronze instruments. There were three main metals used in the temple. There was silver, gold, and copper. So they're all great conductors of electricity. But copper is the only one that can handle the heat. So it's not as expensive as gold or silver, but it can do some things that gold and silver can't do. So anything to do with burning and heat is dealt with copper instruments, and the priests would deal with the burning of the sacrifices on copper instruments. Now, if you have a look at the priestly garments there, they had stones upon their vestments. And they were on a breastplate called a choshen plate. And that word is related to, it's got the word nechash or serpent written, built into it. It's the same letters. And they also had a box-like knitted vestment, multicoloured garment, the same thing that snakes have, a multicoloured garment. They even had, like a rattler, they even had, you know, rattles or bells and so forth along the bottom. And so the whole purpose, the priestly garment is related to the serpent. So the reason that the serpent on the pole, it's a picture of sin, but it's also a picture of priesthood. Remember Moses and Aaron from Leviathan? Okay, Leviathan's the bad guy, but he's a fallen. He's a fallen priest. It talks about him being having a breastplate with nine stones on it. He was the chief cherub that covereth until iniquity was found in him. And he is basically a crooked priest, a crooked serpent. And we can't think of anything good about a serpent in this world because it's fallen. Okay? But essentially, Yeshua was the only one that was in a sense a good serpent. Now, I'm not trying to get people to worship serpents, I'm just trying to relay something about priesthood, that there's a relationship between the two. And indeed the word Mashiach in Hebrew is numerically the same as Nechash, serpent. So he's kind of dealing with the bad guy by being like him in some way. Indeed, when Yeshua comes back, he comes back like a dragon in a sense. Fire comes out of his mouth and consumes the enemies of the Lord. So, I'm not saying that he's a serpent. I'm saying there's an aspect of priesthood that's within him that's like this. And then we can begin to understand what all of this is about. Levi, the priesthood, there's an aspect of the serpent within the priesthood. And by the way, also in the within the kingdom of David, because David, the house of David is likened unto a serpent as well, fiery flying serpent. It says, "Rejoice not thou Palestina, because of him who smote thee is dead," basically, because the king of Judah just died. Because out of the serpent's root, that is out of this son, this Davidic king, will come a fiery flying serpent. And that's talking about Hezekiah. Hezekiah was going to be on their tail, so the Philistines, and teach him a lesson. So Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole, and it came to pass that if a serpent had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. So right here at the center, we have the ministry of Levi. And if Levi, like Moses, was from Levi and Aaron was from Levi, when they put their rods down, what did they turn into? Serpents. It says they turned into Nachashim, Nachash, and also Atan. Uses the same thing. Levi Tan, Levi Nachash. And if Levi is at the center of the encampment, there we have a picture of the serpent on the pole in the actual tribal encampment. So it's God's trying, you know, it says it's the glory of God to hide a matter, but it's the glory of kings to find it out. Satan wants to corrupt the tabernacle. It's like, it's his religion is his game. And it says on his belly he will go, on his Gihon, and the Gihon River or stream goes right through Jerusalem. He's going to go right through the temple. That's where he wants to put the abomination of desolation. He wants to have his way with the woman, Zion. He wants to install his all-seeing eye at the top of the pyramid. So, he wants to say that he's the one, he's the Christ, he's the Mashiach. That's really bent and twisted. Now, we have a picture of the kingdom of God with Israel when they were encamped around the mountain. I'm not sure if they were around the whole mountain there or they were on one side of it, but the mountain represents the kingdom of heaven, as we'll see shortly. In Exodus 24:1 we read, "And he said unto Moses, Come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off." Well, they went up the mountain, but they didn't go all the way up. "And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with them." So Moses received the law by the hands of a mediator. Who was that mediator? It was Yeshua. It was Yod Heh Vav Heh. But you can't see the Lord. Or who was this one that appeared like the heavens in his clearness and under his feet was a paved work of sapphire stones? That's kind of a picture of the bride, by the way. He wherever he walked, he would the ground would change from being just rough rocks to a paved work of sapphire stones. He would transform the world around him just by walking. But, you know, no one can see God. Who was this one that gave the Torah to Moses? It was Yod Heh Vav Heh, the Son. And Moses, at the top of Mount Sinai, and Sinai is related to the word for crown of horns, Sinai. So thorns, Sinai. So this is a picture of the top, the kingdom of heaven, and the priests, the Levitical priests, could only go up so far. They couldn't go all the way. But but Moses could. So he's one Levite that made it up to the top. And I'm going to put it to you that top of the mountain is where we're a part of. Because it says he, talking about John the Baptist, it says he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. So that's us. We're part of Israel, but we've been taken from Israel, but we've raised to a higher level. I'm going to start to bring some of these threads together slowly. In Exodus 19:12, "And thou shalt set bounds unto the people round about, saying, Take heed to yourselves that ye go not up into the mount, or touch the border of it. Whosoever toucheth the mount shall surely be put to death." So Israel can't go to a certain level. They can't go all the way up the mountain. This is what God's been doing in this time of darkness, if you like, since Israel's been in judgment, is he's been building something at a higher level. In John chapter 11, verse 43 and 54, we read, "And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth." The raising of Lazarus is a very, very important scripture, because it's talking about a man that was raised from the dead. This is shortly before the end of Yeshua's ministry and his death on the cross. But it's not mentioned in any other gospel. And I find that really, really peculiar. There's a literal man named Lazarus that was raised from the dead. And then it says, Jesus therefore walked no more. This is a few verses later. Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. This is an encoded message. It's talking about something that did happen. There was a literal man named Lazarus. He was a friend of Yeshua's. But I dare say his name was probably not Lazarus, because we've got this recorded in Greek, and Lazarus is not a Greek name. It's a Greek form of a Hebrew name, Eliezer. And Eliezer was a descendant of one of the Eliezers, was that priest the son of Aaron. But another Eliezer was Eliezer of Damascus. That's spelt with an extra yod in it, and with a yod in it. But Eliezer of Damascus went to get a bride for Isaac. And essentially that's what John the Baptist was about. And he was from the priesthood of Eliezer. What this is about, as I understand it, is yes, all of this literally happened. But this is a foreshadow of the future. When Yeshua is going to reunite the houses, first of all, he's going to raise up the Kohanim, the sons of Eliezer, Lazarus. And they're going to be, and he's going to send those to the Jews. And then he's going to go personally to Ephraim. It says regarding Ephraim that he is my firstborn. So he's going to go personally to the wilderness. Now, it says that he's going to bring Israel, the house of Israel, the 10 lost tribes, to the wilderness of the peoples. So this is an encoded message. It's the only place in the entire New Testament where the name Ephraim is mentioned. So it's very significant. It's not just telling us some story for no reason. And once you start to study the Torah, the New Testament comes together in a way that you couldn't have understood it otherwise. So before God, before the whole tribulation period occurs, we're actually going to have a period of time when the temple and priesthood is going to be in operation and the lost tribes are going to return to Israel. That's the subject of my previous talk. Here we have a message that's telling us a little bit about the reconciliation between the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And one of the important things that Messiah must do is raise up the lost tribes, but he must also get Judah ready to receive us. And he's going to send his servant Lazarus, or Eliezer, the descendant, the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood is going to suddenly wake up, and they're going to start telling their brethren, Jewish brethren, about Yeshua. All right, now we want to talk about something else that's died and will be raised up. It says in Hebrews, but ye come unto Mount Zion. That's spelt with an S in the King James. Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect, and to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better things than that of Abel. Well, I don't know about you, but that really smokes my tires. That really is an amazing thing that we've been brought into. We've been brought into basically this huge, if you want to call it an empire, or something huge and high and lofty, and we've been brought into the very city of the living God. And we're a part of Zion. We're actually Zion. We're the daughter of Zion that fell from heaven, if you like. We've fallen. But we're being brought back home. This is our home. This is where we come from. And then you might say, well, how can we come from there? But, you know, I was born in Auckland, New Zealand, or Pukekohe near Auckland, New Zealand. And I know my mum and my dad. But that's not where I began. That's where my body began. But where did my spirit come from? Well, my spirit came from my father. And at a certain time, he awakened me with the gospel. My job is to persevere to the end. We don't know who's who, but the gospel is God going after his sons. And he's not going to lose any of his sheep. So it's a job of an evangelist to go and get lost. We don't know who's who, but God already does. And we actually had a beginning before our birth. We actually come from two places. It says the wicked go astray from the womb, speaking lies. So there is two seed lines on the earth. Our spirits didn't begin our journey down here. It says regarding the prophet Jeremiah, before you were born I chose you, made you a prophet to the nations. So we have a beginning that's before our exit out of the womb. We have a beginning that's before our entry into our body. We come from somewhere, and that's our mother, the heavenly Jerusalem. Now, how is Zion related to Israel? Well, these two pictures, I'm going to use them to help describe the relationship. As we saw before, the menorah and the showbread are pictures of perhaps Adam and Eve. And they're actually meant to be together. The light's supposed to be on the table. In the book of Revelation, we have the tree of life, Chaim, life. And there's 12 manner of fruits that bear every month. There's 12 months, so that's 144. The 12 loaves are related to the tree of life, Chaim. But the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, if you like, the menorah, which is all about 22 almonds, the 22 letters are on the menorah, that it's related to the light of God's word. God's word is likened unto something that you eat, but it's also related to light. And those two things are actually meant to be joined together in holy matrimony, just like Adam and Eve. And the church is really like it's the menorah. We read about the seven churches. It's the menorah. It's not the table of showbread. We have seven churches in Revelation. We don't have 12 churches, but we have 144,000. They're related to the table of showbread. 12 times 12 times 1,000. So the church is part of Israel. If Israel is Adam, it says in the Bible that Israel is Adam. If Israel is Adam, and by the way, Adam was sent out of the garden, what is the promised land but the Garden of Eden? You can come back in, but you've got to keep my commandments. Initially, there was only one commandment. Don't eat from the tree. Well, the first commandment in the Bible was go forth and multiply. Okay. But the second commandment in the Bible was you can eat anything, but don't eat that tree that I told you about. That's that knowledge of good and evil. What he didn't say is there's a dirty old serpent there that wants to kind of lead you up the garden path. And now God's given Israel umpteen million commandments, if you like. So we've gone from just a few commandments to a whole hang of a lot. And it does say that the Torah was made for sinners. Thankfully, we have the laws. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the law, but the fact that we've got so many laws is because we've lost the plot. We don't know how to think God's way. And so God's use the law is like training wheels to get us back to the Father. It brings us to the Mashiach. So the 12 loaves and the 7-branch candlestick, we can take it to mean man and wife, two aspects of the Messiah as both the bread and the light, but it's also two aspects of Israel. There's Israel and then there's the congregation of Israel. Remember in the Torah we read about the congregation of Israel gathered before Moses. Well, that wasn't all Israel. That was a subset of people. That was like your senators, congressmen. The congregation of Israel wasn't all Israel. It was a subset of Israel. It was the leaders. And it said in the Torah that they were an evil congregation. Well, the Lord is Yeshua when he says, I'm going to build my church. He says, I'm going to build my congregation. Well, what congregation is that? It's a congregation of Israel. But it's part of Israel, but it's kind of separate. It's kind of a little bit elevated because they're leaders. And that's what the church's relationship is to Israel ultimately. There's going to be a time when the church is completed. The congregation of Israel is completed. And then we will reign with Christ over the universe as part of Israel, but kind of separate from it. So this perhaps can you can begin to understand how the church is, it's Israelitish, but it's kind of a little bit different, but it's kind of related. And now as we come to the end of the last days, the church is waking up to its Israelite identity, because we're going to be returning, not up into the heavenlies, we're not going up into the heavenly Mount Zion, we're going to eventually head back to Israel. And the Lord is going to bring the house of Israel, the 10 lost tribes, that he's actually already beginning to awaken here in Texas and all around the world. He's going to bring them back to Israel through via the North Country. We read about that. That might be a bit of a process. All right. So let's just have a look at the encampments in terms of the heavens. In the heavens, we have the signs of the zodiac. And in the northern hemisphere, if you look at the celestial north, you come to the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper, and there's a constellation called Draco in the utmost parts of the north. That represents the dragon, Satan, and he's right at the throne of God, the north being the throne of God. And so Satan is contesting what God is doing. He's contesting us, the accuser of the brethren that accuses us day and night. And the path of the sun through the stars is called the sign of the ecliptic. And I don't have time to explain what all that is, but these constellations, the 12 constellations, represent the 12 tribes. And every three constellations, we have a cherub. We have Aquarius, which is related to the water carrier, the man unstable as water. That's Reuben. We have three constellations later, Scorpio, and above that, the serpent holder, and that's Dan, who's a serpent, by the way. And then three constellations later, we have Leo the lion. That's Judah. Three constellations later, we have Taurus the bull. That's Joseph the ox, Ephraim. And so here we have a picture of the cherubim above our heads. And right within, at the very top of it, in the centre of directly celestial north, we have the dragon in the court, just like he did with Job. He's roaming the earth, seeking whom he devours, but every so often he goes up to present himself before the Lord, and the Lord says, "What have you been doing?" He says, "Walking up and down and to and fro." And he's accusing the brethren. He's saying, "That guy Job, he doesn't love you for nothing. Let me get at him." And, you know, Yeshua said to Peter, you know, "Satan has wished to sift you as wheat, but I prayed for you that your faith doesn't fail and afterwards strengthen your brethren. And we are contesting with Satan today in our own lives. So what we see down in the encampment here is related to this heavenly encampment. Remember, everything that Moses made in the tabernacle was to be copied after the pattern of that which he's seen on the mountain, that which is in heaven. So we have the word Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, it's called a dual in Hebrew. The very name implies there's two Jerusalems. In English we have plurals, you put an S on something, and in Hebrew you put an I-M at the end of it, an M at the end of it, and that becomes a plural. But you also have something called a dual. It's still got the I-M, but it's got different vowels, and it sounds like, for example, shoes, na'alayim, that means two shoes, a pair of shoes. It's not Na'alim, it's Na'alayim. So Yerushalayim implies there's two Jerusalems, one above and one below. So everything that's down here is actually connected to everything that's up there. On the new heavens and the earth, heaven and earth will be at the same place. So we have the heavenly Jerusalem coming down and coming onto the new earth. Now, there's still going to be a heavens, but essentially there's been a bit of a divorce going on between the heavenly realms, and in a sense all the realms are going to realign, and we're going to have heaven on earth, essentially. Okay. So, if we have a look at this diagram here, we have the four cherubim around the base, But the tent of meeting is really related to Zion. Remember, that's where Levi goes. And the Levites could go halfway, but Moses went all the way up the mountain. So the mountain represents the kingdom of heaven, the top of it being the heavenly Mount Zion. Now, here's a representation of Sinai as a picture of heaven. Levi can go up some of the way. In fact, Moses went all the way. And that's where we are. That's where we've come into. Hebrews tells us you've come into the heavenly Jerusalem and to Mount Zion. And we know that Zion fell from the heavens to the earth. So that's where we're a part of. Now, does that look like something that's familiar? Now, that's the Yeshua's priesthood is up here. Levi's priesthood is halfway down and at the base. Okay, Levi is a pattern of that higher priesthood. Now, God's not going to get rid of the priesthood of Levi. They're going to minister to him. Indeed, there are Levites and priests that are part of the heavenly Mount Zion. They get born again. And in this church age, they're part of the heavenly Mount Zion. But now, Satan wants to place himself here. He wants to put his all-seeing eye right here. But the Lord's going to throw him down out of heaven. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth, for the devil has come down with great wrath, for he has a short time, Revelation 12. And that's when he's contesting with the woman, who is Zion. She has 12 stars about her head. So the builders, here are the builders. And they're wanting to build Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new world order of the ages, or a new secular order. They want to build Zion, but they want to build it without the capstone. They're going to build Babylon, but they're going to try and build Zion as well. And they're going to, Lucifer wants to place himself in the temple. That's part of his five eye wills. We'll talk about that very soon. It's very interesting because, there are four cherubim here, but there's a fifth one, and that's related to the woman. It's related to the church. It's related to, really where Satan fell from, as the chief cherub that covereth. So he was really up here around the throne of God. The throne of God's at the top of the pyramid.
Can you point up there so we can see where you're pointing?
The throne of God is there, if you like. All right. So this is Israel at the base, you know, with the 12 tribes gathered in four groups of three, headed by a lion, eagle, ox, man, and so the dragon is up here contesting, and at the very time that he is thrown down, her son rises. We'll talk about that soon. Now, the rings of the Olympic Games, which were introduced by the Nazis, and so was the flaming torch, you know, during the Olympic procession. That was introduced by Adolf Hitler. The Olympic Games are a supremely pagan event. And it revolves around a pagan calendar called the Julian calendar, Gregorian calendar. And those five rings, there are four cherubim, but there's a fifth cherub. And it's interesting because a Malach is related to that fifth cherub, but he's related to a serpent. He's related to a fiery serpent, Nachashim Seraphim. He's related to Seraph. He's Satan's child. And when Israel returns to the land, a Malach attacks from behind. And that's what happened in World War II. The Jews were sitting around Europe too long. They didn't recognize the time to get out of Dodge. And a Malach attacked. I'm not saying all Germans are from Amalek. I'm saying a lot of the Nazis in Germany were. And they've come across the ditch to America, and a lot of them have come to Australia too, and to Adelaide. And they're awaiting their time. When God wants to judge Israel, he will send the fiery serpents. He will send Amalek. And this time they won't be just attacking the Jews, they'll be attacking Ephraim and the lost tribes. So sometimes it's good to see patterns, but I'm not worried. Because my eyes are on the Lord. I'm not looking on the waves. God has made a covenant with the house of Israel and Judah, and it's up to us as Christians, whether we're from Israel and Judah or not, to keep covenant, to keep his commandments, to walk with them. And I can only say that that's we need God's grace because we fail in many ways. But if we humbly seek the Lord, we'll find him if we seek him with all our heart. And the times that are going to come to America and Australia and elsewhere are not... God is going to bring a lot of destruction to the church, but it's also going to save the church. But the New World Order and these guys are going to try and kill us. When God sent the serpents out to bite the Israelites, the serpents weren't slack in doing it. They loved their job. And they would bite until the cows come home. But thankfully the Lord stopped the biting. So when we read the Torah, we're reading about the future. God is going to, he's not going to destroy Zion. That's what we're a part of. And he's not out to destroy us. Some people get martyred, but the bulk of us are going to get through if we're following after. God's not raising up the Torah-based believers just to let us drown, because God keeps covenant. He says, if you do this, I'll do that. You do this, I'll do that. God said to Israel, if you're scattered to the four corners of the earth or the four corners of the heavens, from there I'll regather you, if you and your children keep my commandments. So this should be motivation for parents to teach their kids the commandments and to for us to walk humbly. Sadly, some messianics get proud because they learn some stuff. All I've found is the more I learn, the more I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to show you how little I know, so that you too will know as much as I do, which is 2/3 of 5/8, and not very much. I mean, we don't know much, but we know enough. He's given us a big picture, and all the Torah is details. More and more details, and there's going to come a time when we're going to need to know those things, including the stuff that happened in the past. So, let's talk a little bit about the one that wants to put his eye at the top of the unfinished work, the great work, which didn't just begin in 1776. That's just the modern day builders that we've been building ziggurats since we left the garden. Isaiah 14. For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Well, that's good. I mean, you know, if my son wanted to be like me, I'd take it as a compliment, but not when he wants to knock me on the head. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell. That's what Absalom's all about, spirit of Satan. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. So he's told us all this in advance. So what is this one that's in the sides of the north? Beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the sides of the north. So Satan wants to exalt himself. He wants to take over Zion. That's where he wants to put his eye. He wants to put his eye in Zion. On the sides of the north, the city of the great king. So that's what Satan wants to do. Because he says, I want to ascend to the clouds. I want to ascend above the congregation. That's us. We're the congregation. He wants to reign over the church. And much of what's called the church in America and Australia is sadly the church of Satan. The ministers, I'm not saying all the people in it, but Satan's basically almost taken over the Protestant churches in this country and my country. Yeshua is the head of all principality and power, and he's the head of the church. And Satan is going, nan, 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 now I've got your church. He took over what became the Catholic Church through paganism, and now the Protestant doors have basically hoard and become the same sort of harlot. And so we know that destruction is coming, but there's the true church, which is amongst it all. And the Lord's going to bring us home and out of all of this. So it says, when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. By the way, how did God bring a lot of the Jews to Israel? Through the Holocaust, through the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. And the fiery serpents are out there burning the Jews, and they're going to do the same thing with the rest of Zion, if you like. And that's us, if they can. And they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and brought bracelets. I want to talk about how Israel and the church are connected. And they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and brought bracelets and earrings and rings and tablets and jewels of gold, and every man that offered an offering of gold unto the Lord. Now, Paul tells us that we're a temple. We're a tabernacle. We're a temple for the Spirit of God. Now, that here we have an Exodus, a recording of the Israelites bringing offerings to build the tabernacle and all the vessels. And it says they came, both men and women. And I don't want to cause people to blush, but it doesn't say that in Hebrew. It says basically, Vayavo'u ha'anashim el ha'anashim, and the men came upon the women, and they brought all these bits and pieces. So what does this mean? It means that the tabernacle was built out of their descendants, out of their seed. That all of these offerings were actually us. We are the base material to build the tabernacle. We are the tabernacle being built out of living stones. With God, this whole picture of the building of the tabernacle was a real tabernacle. But God by His Spirit is saying in Hebrew something more than that. He's saying that I'm going to build something called a tabernacle, which is going to be made out of the seed of Israel. The men will come upon the women, and they will bring through the offerings of their hearts all the materials. This is like their children. They bought bracelets and earrings and rings and tablets and jewels of gold and all of these things. So the tabernacle was built out of what was contributed by the Israelites. And what was contributed by the Israelites was their progeny. If Israel is all the tents around the tabernacle itself is the church of the firstborn, which is Israelite, but it's also Israel on a higher level. That may be a little bit much for people to take in. When I read this stuff in Hebrew, I can see what God's trying to say. He's not just telling me about the materials of a building project that means nothing to me today. The whole tabernacle was a picture of the heavenly encampment. We know that. We reread that before, where we saw the tabernacle at the center and the four groups of tribes around the side relating to the four cherubim. So the whole tabernacle is a picture of the heavenly hierarchy or encampment. It's what fell, Zion that fell. And He's rebuilding it. And He's rebuilding it out of the seed of the descendants of these people, both men and women. Again, a little bit of Hebrew helps. So here we have three pictures, and they all represent Zion and the Church of the Firstborn, which I believe is the same thing, because we've come to the heavenly Jerusalem, Mount Zion, in Hebrews. So that's what we're a part of. Here we have the seven churches. Here we have the seven churches. And here's a Levitical priest. Yeshua is related to that central pillar. But also that you could imagine seven of these actual menorahs arranged around Yeshua at the center of them. That making 49 lights in total, with Him being the 50th. Okay, and then we have the counting of the Omer, 50 days. You could picture it like this. This is the church. It's a woman. And the central shaft is called the Shemesh, which is the word for sun, as in the sun in the sky. But it's also the word for deacon, someone that's servant. It's the servant candle. It's a bit higher than the others. And you light this one first, and then you light these ones from that. Just so happens that that's related to the church of Thyatira, the fourth church. And the we're going to look at that shortly, because the two churches that have two amazing overcoming privileges. But let's talk about her son. In Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 5, and there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child who was to rule the nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And who is that child? No. Yes, it is, but no, it's not. Yeshua died. This man-child goes straight to heaven. Yes, it is. It's in type, it is Yeshua, but in type it's not. There's some differences. Well, who else rules with a rod of iron over the nations? Yes, Yeshua is the head of this, if you like. He's the centre of it, but it's not him alone. This child didn't get crucified. The woman gives birth to it midway through the tribulation. He doesn't have time to get crucified. It's, yes, it is harkening back to Yeshua, but it's actually about something that's happening right then in Revelation chapter 12. This is something, a topic that Christians haven't got a clue about. Zion in pain to be delivered. For I have heard the voice of a voice of a woman in travail. So the same picture in Revelation chapter 12 is in Jeremiah. For I have heard a voice of a woman in travail, and the anguish as of her that bringeth forth her first child. What's this about? The voice of the daughter of Zion that bewaileth herself and spreadeth her hand, saying, woe is me now, for my soul is weary because of murderers. Now that was happening in Yeshua's time, so you could say that this son is Yeshua, and in a sense you're exactly right. But we read in Revelation chapter 2 regarding the church of Thyatira, and he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. So there are going to be overcomers of the church of Thyatira in the last days that are going to rule over the nations with a rod of iron, just like this man-child. And they are from that fourth church, the Shemesh. And that's the masculine. See, these are feminine branches, curved. They come off the side, but this is her seed. If you imagine that's the woman, this is from her womb. This is her son. Now, there's intimations of this son, this one that is related to iron, in a little story in 2 Kings. So, 2 Kings chapter 6. So he went with them, and when they came to Jordan, which represents death, Jordan represents death, Naaman goes into the Jordan, an old man, dies and is reborn. He goes down 7 times, 7 days, 7,000 years, new beginning, new heavens and new earth. So he went down, John the Baptist baptized in the Jordan. Jordan means to go down. So he went with them, and when they came to Jordan, they cut down wood. Okay, cool. But as one was felling a beam, the axe head fell into the water, and he cried and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. Now, if you read this in English, you go, dum-de-dum-de-dum. If you read it in Hebrew with your eyes open, all of a sudden alarm bells go. First of all, the axe head is not called an axe head. It's called iron. It's just called the iron fell into the water. And he says, alas, for it was Sheol. It was Sha'ol. Sha'ol. Remember King Shaul? It's related to the word Sheol, the grave. So the axe, the iron goes into the grave. And the man of God said, where fell it? And he showed him a place, and he cut down a stick and cast it thither, and the iron did swim. The iron came up through the cross. That's how I understand it anyway. Something fell. Remember Zion fell, the daughter of Zion fell? Well, there's the woman. There's the woman with the 12 stars about her head. She's now not fallen anymore. She's in the heavens, if you like, you know, figuratively speaking. She's standing on the moon cloaked with the sun. She's walking in holiness. The dragon can't kill her. He falls out of heaven. He goes, oh, I better go get her and her child. Can't touch her. The earth opens up her mouth and consumes him. It consumes his army, but like Korah. Okay, there's some of the connections. So the iron swam. Why is God telling us this silly story about some guy chopping down some trees? It's the glory of God to hide a matter. It's the glory of kings to search it out. He's telling us something about the last days. He's just telling us about the one that's going to rule with a rod of iron. Remember Superman? You know Superman is the man of steel. Okay. Stalin called himself the man of steel. The Israelites, when they came to Canaan, they couldn't get the guys that had the steel chariots. So, you know, what did the Nazis wear? The iron cross. Okay, so in order to deal with steel, you need to be a man of steel. Okay, these are the men of steel. So, did Israel fall? Did the man-child fall? Yes, he did. The iron fell. But then a stick was thrown in and it caused it to swim. Could that be related to what's happening in Revelation chapter 12 with the man-child? The daughter of Zion has a child. Now, yes, when you go back to Genesis chapter 3, we have, I'll put enmity between thy seed and her seed. Yes, that's Christ, and yes, the Antichrist. Yes, it's Christ. Yes, it's Satan. But it's also her seed. It talks about the woman in Revelation 12. The dragon can't touch her, but he goes after the remnant of her seed, they that keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Yeshua amongst the nations. So her seed doesn't just include literal Israel, includes the nations that believe on him, but Satan's able to kill them, but he can't kill her seed, her literal seed, her son. And that's this axe. This is that these are the overcomers of the Church of Thyatira. If you read the letter to the Church of Thyatira, yes, it may have applied to people in Catholic times or during the Protestant Reformation, but much more it's going to be in last days Babylon. And in the end times empire, the ten toes, iron mixed with miry clay, which is human and non-human. We're going to be entering very supernatural times at that stage. We're not there yet. We're perhaps inching towards it. In Isaiah, we read, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. Well, who are his disciples? Who's Yeshua's Talmudim? If you want to, the way I read this, there's perhaps a number of ways, but I can see intimations that the Torah is a sealed book. It's a sealed book except for his disciples. So the Torah is actually a love story for his disciples. And it's only going to be opened up in the last days. It's the biggest coded book in the universe. And when I say the Torah, by extension, that's the prophets. And by extension, that's the New Testament. We're going to come into a time when knowledge will increase. And also deception will increase. And I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts which dwelleth in Mount Zion. If you read Revelation chapter 14, the Lamb is on Mount Zion and the 144,000 are with him. Is that what he's talking about? We know that Yeshua is Yahweh. So when we're reading Isaiah chapter 8, we're reading about the future. We're reading about the stuff in the book of Revelation. That's how I read it. I just I put it to you that Mount Zion, does that mean that they're in the literal earthly Mount Zion or the heavenly Mount Zion in Revelation 14? I'm not sure, but the point is that I think it links up with Isaiah 8. And that's related to the 144,000. But it's that 144,000, as I understand it, is not part of, it's not the daughter of Zion herself. It's not actually the church of the firstborn. So we've seen the death of Israel and Adam, the Messiah, and Lazarus, Zion, and the man child. And there's aspects of all of those that died outside of time. And there seems to be, from the way I read the verses, there's something going on before Adam, when the earth was tohu vavohu, when it was formless and void. So the reason I've brought this whole thing is to show you that there is a much bigger thing going on. There's stuff that happened before Adam. Not only that, but this is beyond the subject of this talk, but I think there's intimations in the Torah about time dilation and things happening, moving through time, changing time, traveling through time. The prophets were actually taken from one place in time and taken literally to another place in time. According to Einstein, we live in this continuum called space-time. And time and space is actually part of one big thing. We think we're going through in time, and we are. But actually, time and space is part of the same thing. So when you're traveling very fast, the speed of light, time changes. It's an illusion. This whole created universe, if you like, this time thing, is like a big CD. It's already been made. God can take someone from one part of the story and translate them not only to another place, like the eunuch, like Philip, but he can take people to another time. He can take them to another dimension. He can take them from here on earth to up into the heavens. So the fact that there was something going on before Adam is a small deal compared to that. God is above time, and in some ways so are we. Sometimes we can sense things ahead of time. Adam was made on the sixth day, and there were 6 days to creation. There's 6 directions. There's forward and backwards. There's up and down, and left and right. But there's a little bit more to Adam than all of that, because what God breathed into him is himself. So there's a part of us that's outside of time and space. It says that we are crucified with Christ. So there's a part of us, in a sense, that's outside of time and space. And we're to reckon ourselves to be dead. There was something else I was going to mention, and I've just forgotten it. Anyway, Lord, if it's important, I'll bring it to mind. Hopefully from this study you can perhaps appreciate the great work and struggle that we are a part of. We have spanned time before Adam, when the earth became formless and void. During this time, Lucifer, Halal ben Shachar, fell to become Satan. Zion fell from heaven to earth at this time. Then we had the slaying of all the house of Israel. That's in the Valley of Dry Bones. They were slain. They didn't die of natural causes. And then the Lamb was slain before the foundation of the world. The heavens are black because of something that happened before Adam, before God replenished the earth. At some stage in the future, this knowledge of prehistory will be important, because it is written in the Bible for a purpose. God is not just telling us stuff so that Rory can have a little talk about something in the end of time, about something that sounds all very interesting. He's actually put it there for a reason. And the end times may be about time and time dilation and things that we may need to know what happened in the past in order to perhaps comprehend some of the things that are happening right then and there. Again, I'd beg to differ with a lot of prophecy teachers. I don't believe the next thing is the tribulation. I think the next thing that's coming is trouble, big trouble in little China and here in America. So we're told that the end is in the beginning. So if we want to understand the last days, we need to understand the first days. And therefore, if we really want to understand the end, get back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and then have a look at verse 2, because something happened there. And something happened outside of time that caused the earth and the world and the cosmos to be in this chaotic, formless, void state, tohu bavohu. The Sabbath is the only commandment of the 10 that is about time. as we move forward to the beginning, we see a restoration of all things. This is far more than just a restoration of Israel and Zion as we know it today. We're going to come to a time when God's going to, at some stage, restore the lost tribes back to the land. That's going to be a big deal, but that's only the beginning. Then the bride must make herself ready, and then all this stuff in the book of Revelation will come to pass at some stage. So there's what we've seen is that Zion fell from heaven. She is shining with the sun, standing on the moon in Revelation 12. She can't be touched by the dragon. So this is good news. He can get the remnant of his seed, but he can't get her child and he can't get her. So believing Israel is cast out into the wilderness, but she's all right. So the story of Zion, of what God's doing in the church, is not... It didn't have its beginnings with Adam. It had its beginnings before Adam. So we're a part of something that's really huge. And at some stage, this heavenly, supernatural, multi-dimensional, outside of time and space thing is going to start impinging on our reality. I don't think we're here yet, but we're going to be moving towards that. So what can we conclude from all of this? God is big. And I didn't know how else to put it, because I could put a whole lot of things together, but for me it just goes, how all I can say is, my God, how great thou art. You know, Father, you've got everything under control. There's so much that I didn't know, and now that you've shown me some more stuff that I didn't know, I've got a whole lot more questions. We're going to need to know some of this stuff. If anything that I've said, if there's any shadow of truth to it, there'll come a time when it will be not just interesting to know, it'll be vital. Because he hasn't put the fall of Zion in there for titillate us. But for now, all I can conclude is God is big. Thanks.
So, based on what you're saying, can you help contrast a few concepts, from your perspective, like Zion versus House of Israel, and then how that might relate to Judah and Ephraim?
Well, you know, Zion is in Jerusalem, but not all of Israel's in Jerusalem. Israel's all around Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's the city of the king, and one day Zion shall be lifted up, and Jerusalem shall be lifted up above all other mountains. So there's that Sinai thing going on again. So Israel's around the base, if you like, and Israel comes up to Zion, and we have in the new heavens and new earth, it comes down like a bride, the heavenly Jerusalem, and all the gates are named after the 12 tribes, and they all come in and go out. But Zion herself is like this ruling body that rules over Israel, and then through that over the universe and the nations. So Zion is a part of Israel, and Israel is a part of Zion. But Zion is like the Senate; it's just above, if you like. And
are you saying that Zion is a place, or is it a people within a people?
It's a people. Just imagine your Congress, okay? Are congressmen Americans?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they should be. Some governors aren't Americans. I mean, Arnie's from Austria or somewhere.
But they're going to say Auschwitz.
There you go. But, you know, okay, so Congress is American. And congressmen are Americans, but not all Americans are congressmen.
Right.
That's what Zion is. Not all Israelites are Zion, if you like. The daughter of Zion seems to be a select group. that.
But that's not to say that also the Levites or priests or anything are only Zion either.
No.
Yeah.
No, indeed. That's what we've been brought into. Well, actually, remember, the Levites could only go halfway up.
Right.
And actually, if you look, take that whole tabernacle thing, that symbology, the tabernacle is us, but the Levites minister in the tabernacle.
Right.
So they minister to us. But some of us might be Levites.
Right.
Okay, but there's going to be a time when the church is completed, what's called the congregation is completed. You know, the bride makes herself ready. There's going to be a time when there's a marriage of the Lamb. There's going to be a time when Zion is the perfection of beauty, because that's what she was. She fell. She got a bit dirty. God killed her. And he's been raising Zion up. And then there's there's something within that congregation. There's going to be one particular congregation related to the man of steel, if you like, that rules with a rod of iron. That's her son. And that's, as I understand it, the overcomers of Thyatira that rule with a rod of iron, like Yeshua.
So the man child is not one person.
No.
It is a
group.
Unity of people who stand like Pinchas, for example.
That's
or somebody
exactly
who
right.
says the men in valor say, we are going to rule with a rod of iron, we're going to rule with this.
That's right.
Gotcha.
That's right. And so, and this is going to happen at the fall of Satan. Lucifer fell and became Satan. That was in the past. But Satan is going to fall. He still has access to the heavens. And he's the accuser of the brethren. And in Revelation 12, he's cast down. And he can't do his job anymore. And he's going, well, what am I going to do? You know, because all I've ever done is deceive, lie, and kill. I guess I'll just have to do that on earth. And so he goes out of his way to try and kill as many people as he can. Can't get the woman. Read it. Revelation 12. Hey, you. She can't be touched.
She's from Lubbock.
What's that?
She's from Lubbock.
Oh,
your accent.
You know, the Wile E. Coyote's after
a bit. Is it okay if we think it out loud? Because I know Kevin's got much more intelligent questions than I do. Just kind of stumbling.
This is all new sort of stuff.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So I'm going to kind of try to repeat back to you a concept I think you said.
Yep.
And you tell me if this is what you actually mean. Is that right? Is that fair?
Okay.
And
that's
if
I can understand what you're saying, I'll see.
And I hope this doesn't sound too like science fiction-y, but this is how I thought I heard what you're saying.
Yep.
So you're saying, let me start by saying, you know, there's places in the Bible where in the New Testament Jesus will say something like, those that are mine, or, and it seems to imply like the great confusion of, you know, predestination versus free will, and what does he mean, those that are mine, how are they already his, that whole thing, right? Okay, so with that in mind, it sounds like you're saying that something happened before Adam, maybe in our spirits, I don't know how that works, I have no clue.
Neither do I.
Don't know, I have no idea, but for the sake of English language, I'm going to say spiritually, I don't know, our spirits, something happened that some of the...
Something that was up there fell.
Yeah, and so like maybe some, well, in the whole dry bones thing,
yeah.
Said that Zion was slaughtered, so maybe it's on some level something we don't know happened that people that belonged to God were somehow slaughtered some way we don't understand right now.
Yeah.
And those are the people maybe that Jesus is referring to when he says, those that are mine, those that the Father's given me. In that sort of verbiage?
So
is that what you're kind of saying?
Okay, that's one of the things that I wasn't really saying, but I'm that's
well,
basically...
No,
that's something I take for granted. This whole predestination, free will thing, for me, it's not even an argument worth arguing about, because it's very clear right from Genesis that there are two seed lines. Okay?
Right.
And people don't take that seriously. Well, who is the seed of the serpent? It's the bad guys. It's the wicked.
Right.
Ultimately, because we know who the righteous are, because the seed of the woman are they that keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Yeshua.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The remnant of his seed. So that's the seed of the woman. That's Zion, and I've already shown you the scriptures that link the woman in travail to Zion. So the woman is Zion, and yes, it's related to the church, and that, yes, it's related to Israel, and I've been trying to show the differences between and how they're connected, that Zion is a part of Israel, but it's a group above Israel, if you like. It's the senators, let's put it that way, or congressmen. But there's something about us that's outside of time and space. There's only two camps. There's only sheep and goats. There's only wheat and tares. There's no purgatory. But the only purgatory there is this world. This little life we have, this is our purgatory. This is where we get to work things out, if you like, if I wanted to. I'm not endorsing purgatory. I'm just using the word. Okay, so predestination versus free will. There's a part of me that was breathed into me choosing God. Mm-hmm. So there's a part of me that's actually God choosing God. So there's no dichotomy. God within me is choosing God. If someone is not from God, then they choose that which is not from God. Well, then you say, where is the free will? Well, I'm freely choosing who my daddy is, which is my daddy. And those that have another father are freely choosing their father. So this battleground down here is a battleground between something that happened in the past. Something that fell that can't be redeemed, and something that fell that can. Now that's the conclusion that I've made. That Zion fell, and that she's... This is, in a way, because it says in Ecclesiastes, everything that's been has been already. So there's a lot of clues in the Bible, but people don't want to think about it. And the more I study the Torah, the crazier I get. in some sense, you know, the Torah is telling us about supernatural and reality. This world, I've always called it the supernatural ordinary world. It's ordinary, but it's only on the outside. It's actually a supernatural world. And you just have to look a little bit beyond the veil. We can see in our own lives God working. Our life is impacted by angels and demons, and we don't focus on that. We focus on the King of Heaven. But this is a supernatural, ordinary world. This is really just a big matrix for us to make some decisions, if you like. You know, the real me is like Neo, you know, in the bathtub, you know, plugged in. But I'm actually seated with Christ in heavenly places. Yeah. I think there's something like that going on. I haven't worked it all out.
Right. But the gist.
This is a real world that I'm going to be judged in. But in some senses, it's also like a dream that I'll wake up from. When that world that's beyond the veil is more real.
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, there's plenty of things about time. One day in thy courts is like 1,000 on earth. Well, 1,000 years, not 1,000 days. So that's 1,000 times 360. That's 365,000 times. It takes 365,000 days to make one of God's days. Okay, so I was watching a movie last night, pagan movie, Interstellar. And when you get close to a black hole, time dilates. And the chaps that were near this planet, near this black hole, they were going through so many hours, but that was so many years back on Earth. Well, God tells us the same thing. So time is not the way we think it is. What was the name of that car that we saw, that red one?
Oh, it was the Audi D6, I think.
Yeah, it has a really nice red anodized aluminium sort of frame. It looks really cool. The sort of thing I'd like to have, but I can't. And but if I travelled in that Audi at the speed of light, I think that every minute there would be like an eternity back here, you know, because I'm slowing down. My experience of time is different as I approach the speed of light. It's interesting. It's light, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And God is light. So when we come to God, who is light, we experience like one day, we come back to earth and it's 365,000 days or 1,000 years. So there's a whole aspect to time that's outside of our experience, everyday experience, but that's strongly hinted. Adam, God says, on the day you said to Adam, the day you eat that fruit there, you're going to cark it. And as we say in Australia, I don't know that expression, where you'd cark it.
Cark it, you'd die.
It means you'd die. Oh. But he didn't die in that day. He died spiritually, if you like, but he died literally also, because he lived 930 years, which is just 70 years short of 1,000 years. And 1,000 years is one day. See, when he was in the garden, in the presence of the Lord with the cherubim, sorry, the cherubim weren't flashing swords at that time, but he was in the courts of the Lord. And it talks about the Garden of Eden and the trees of the field envying the Assyrian who was in the Garden of God, who was like Pharaoh and blah, blah, blah. Well, Pharaoh was like Assyrian. And all the other trees envied him. Well, trees don't envy anybody. But angels do, or people do. So the Garden of Eden is also the heavenly court. It's basically what the tabernacle represents. That's why you've got pomegranates and palm trees and lions. It's Eden. Even when you get up to the heavenly court, we've got a lion, an ox, an eagle, and a man. You know, you go to some king's courts and they'd have some leopard on a leash or something like that. I don't know, something about kings and animals goes together. I just think it's great. But even in heaven, we've got the same thing going on. So, there's an aspect of something that's outside of time. And we're not given all the details of what happened in the past, but God hints at it. Stuff that happened before Adam. We know that Lucifer fell before Adam. He was the prince of Tyre, or king of Tyre. It talks about the king of Tyre, and then it starts talking about him being a cherubim in the Garden of God. And you go, when did that happen? Well, it wasn't on the Tyre here on earth. Now, it was on the Tyre on earth before Adam. Mm-hmm. And that's when the cities were broken down. They weren't populated by the birds of the heavens fled. Well, where do birds fly to if everything... They went somewhere else. We get to Genesis chapter 1 and the whole world is not only tohu bavohu, but it's covered in water. So quite a bit's happened. Where does a bird go to if the whole world's covered in water? Where did they fly to and what birds were they? It talks about birds being Satan and his angels, you know, and demons mm-hmm. and so forth. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you piece things together and you get a little bit of a bigger picture. And by the time you get it all figured out, no one's going to believe you. They'll lock you up. Yeah. That's basically it.
But, so with this...
She's got a good
Teresa.
Question.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not so much a question, but... When we started the Torah portion over this year, and I couldn't get past Genesis 1-2. I was stuck at Genesis 1-1. And it took me... I mean, I just stopped there, and the Lord was like, there's something here that you need to learn.
Yep.
And it's like, what is it? I mean, because I could not go past Genesis 1-2. And so I know this is just mm-hmm. amazing, but then Liz sent me a teaching, and it was pretty much talking about the same thing you're
thinking.
Right.
And she's
like, Teresa, what do you think of this? I just need to know. I was like, Liz, this is way beyond what my little pea-sized brain could even think, but it just makes sense to my spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, that shows that there's something outside of time within us,
yeah.
and it's kind of connecting the dots. Yeah. My sheep hear my voice, and the voice of a stranger will they not hear.
But, and also in Psalm 132:13, where... Yahweh says, well, Yahweh has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it.
Yep, yep.
So.
And so there's a Zion above, but there's also a Zion below. And eventually those two Zions become one. That's the whole, at the end of 1,000 years on the new heavens and new earth. The heavenly Jerusalem, we know Zion's in Jerusalem. So the heavenly Jerusalem comes down, the big mothership, comes down to the earth. And then we have Zion, the heavenly Zion, and the earthly Zion being one. And that's kind of like there's an aspect of Adam, he was in the Garden of Eden, was that on earth or was it in the heavens? Because when I go down to Mesopotamia, I don't see cherubim with flashing swords, unless they're invisible. And they may be. But it could be that what happened was that when Adam sinned, there was a separation that occurred. And that all of a sudden now he's going down to this lower realm, our realm, that is 365,000 days to one of God's days, or 1,000 years to one of God's days. So I sometimes get confused which Zion the Lord's talking about. Like when I get to Revelation, is that the earthly Zion that he's with the 144,000, or is it the heavenly one? Well, if he's on earth, then no one's supposed to see him because he hasn't had his second coming yet. So I can't work it all out, but certainly Zion did fall. He's restored. He gets to a place where Zion's restored. And we're going to be a part of that wherever that is, mm-hmm. either up there or down there. Was there anything else you wanted to say there? Or?
No, that's okay.
I'm glad that we talked about this because it makes me feel better that like I'm actually giving out something that is
confirmation.
And so this is interesting stuff. For me, it's really interesting because in a way I'm kind of walking through this world, but it's not really what I'm about. So is there any other questions? Because there's heaps we can talk about. It's just...
Dave had a question.
Mine is rambling. Kevin's got good questions. He's got.
Well, you have good questions.
No, I'm
that's okay. Kevin, go.
We can get the whiteboard on.
I want to hear your
question. Do some stuff.
Go, Dave. Let's hear you.
Honestly, mine are not as intelligent as Kevin.
No, honestly, you always tell us.
Yes.
It's foolish, guys. It's silly.
We're all laughing. It doesn't look. It's not about being right or wrong.
No, I don't mean to be right or wrong. I'm not saying
thus saith the Lord. I'm just presenting what I've found.
No, I hear you. I'm captivated by something that I know I read months back when we were looking into the regathering of the second Exodus and the regathering of the tribes. And it was something that jumped out at me. I think it was in Amos, but I don't know. So my error in not studying well enough is going to sound foolish.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get there in a second. There's two things that I'm intrigued on. One of them mainly is that the church of the firstborn.
Well,
firstborn meaning the people before Adam?
Well, I don't.
That's interesting.
The firstborn after Adam. That ties in with me. You guys, those who are close to me, know I've been kind of like fixated on this daughter of Zion. Who is, what is, and why reference, if it's Israel, a daughter?
I think it's obvious it's actually related to us.
I know it is, but I'm saying how and what, and in what sense is it the feminine sense constantly around, and then menorah and all this stuff. There's something there that I want to grasp, wrestle with, and ask for revelation around, but I see it all throughout here.
There's obvious...
I'm looking at something I know is important, but I don't know what I'm looking at.
Well, remember, there's the menorah on one side and the table of showbread on the other. The 144,000 seem to be related to the 12,000 from each tribe, so that's related to the 12 loaves.
And the 144,000 are protecting the woman in the wilderness, and the man-child is the ones who are going out and doing great exploits, possibly?
No, the man-child just goes straight up. Beam me up, Scotty.
I know,
gets up to the starship Zion.
But we see him ruling with a rod of iron. Ruling what? If he's not going
up. No. That's when he comes back.
Okay.
Okay, so when Yeshua returns, I can only imagine it's... The saints of the Old Testament are raised up in glory.
Yeah.
We're raised up at some stage. This mortal puts on immortality. And the saints that were executed during the tribulation, they're raised up. The man-child didn't get slaughtered. He just comes back. I wouldn't want to be the bad guys on that day because the Lord's not taking prisoners. We're going to return with him. If we suffer with him, we reign with him. How it's obvious that the tabernacle and God's plan, there is a, you know, we're all one in Christ, but if we suffer with him, we will reign with him. So there are levels of reward, and there is a hierarchy in the heavens. There are people that will sit on his right hand, on his left hand. There's people that have a high place. There's some people that get in as by fire, you know, by the skin of their teeth.
My struggle with simply saying what I wish I remember I studied with is something in Amos where I got the impression of, and I know you guys have heard this before, It sounded as though, in that verse that I read, that it seems like, here's my plan. And it does rely, your obedience is relying on having my plan come through the way I desire it. So, it is my will, but if Israel or the tribes do not come in to agreement with us and make us happen, then they will all be wiped out. I remember reading something about that really came across that way.
I think it's in Jeremiah.
Jeremiah? So my thought is that the reflection of where this could have gone wrong? Because we know Yahweh is cyclical.
Yeah.
Is that the possibly the first time this went around before Adam, and maybe that didn't happen?
I think
so we know now. Sorry. So we know now. That's what we're needing to know what happened before, so we know not to make that mistake again.
I think these things will be revealed.
Very Matrix, I know.
I think these things will be revealed to us. And as I say, the Sabbath is the key to it. It's like the key to prophecy in some ways. If you don't have the Sabbath, you don't have the feast. And Leviticus mentions the seven feasts, introduces the 7 days of creation, or 6 days, and then the seventh day. And then it talks about the seven feasts, showing that the seven feasts are related to the 7 days of creation. The 7 days of creation are mentioned in the first chapter of the Bible. So, and the seven, and the Hebrew calendar is mentioned in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, I think it is. The sun, moon, and stars are made for days and seasons, and seasons is Moedim. So if we don't have an understanding of the seasons of Moedim and the feasts, preceded by the Sabbath, we're not going to understand the 7 days of creation. We're not going to understand what God is doing in these epochs. And for a long time, we haven't needed to. The last 2,000 years, most people have been just battling just to walk with the Lord, simply, by faith. But as we come to the end days, we come to the culmination of everything, and we're going to need to dot our I's and cross our T's. And at some stage, some of us are going to need to know some of these details, and some people more than others. So I think we will understand more and more as time progresses. There is so much that's supernatural, as I've shared with you regarding, the 15 songs of ascent, Shir Malot in Hebrew, and the fact that the ark rose upon the waters, and the waters went 15 cubits above the mountains, and it used the same sort of ma'alot, the same sort of terminology, and automatically I'm thinking the 15 songs of ascent, and what is the ark but the bride, and it's the groom as well. Yeshua walked upon the water, and it says that the ark, talach al-hamayim, the ark walked upon the water. It says in the English, the ark rested upon the water. It didn't rest, it walked upon the water. So when Jesus walked upon the water, he's the groom, and the guys in the ark, and then the boat, that's the ark. So there's going to come at the waters. Remember the fountains of the deep were opened, and the fountains, the portals of the heavens, the windows of the heavens were opened, and the water deluge came. That very thing that destroyed the wicked lifted up the bride.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, lifted up the woman. So it's going to, by the way, birth, there's a lot of water involved.
Mm-hmm.
So the baby comes out with the water. Okay, so and it's a messy business. There's a lot of blood and there's a placenta and all of this sort of stuff. And that's what the last days are going to be like. It's going to be this bloody, wet deluge. Satan falls at the very time, and the water that comes out of his mouth is the very thing that lifts the bride up, if you like. She's at that very stage, she's shining like the sun, clothed with the moon. That doesn't sound like she's whoring around. Sounds like she's pristine. She's a woman white, okay? She can't be touched by the accuser because there's nothing, you can't pin anything on her. There's no power. And even when he says, I'm going to throw my kids after you, and the water that comes out of his mouth, the earth opens up a mouth and gets rid of all those corers, if you like. Whether they're angels, it says he takes a third of the stars from heaven. That's a third of the angels fall. We wrestle not against with flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. It's not just demons, it's also angels in the heavens that haven't filled up that cup of iniquity. So as we move to the future, we'll start to see these things more and more. But Sabbath is part of the key, or at least there's a lot of things we're not going to understand without that. And that really does differentiate the woman seems to be believing Israel. And she's Zion. I haven't worked out the difference between Zion and the daughter of Zion. Obviously, there's a difference there. I don't know what that is. I have to kind of look into that, and maybe God will give me insight. And the other thing is, we're not going to work it all out individually. We'll all have little pieces of the puzzle. And that's why God wants people to share stuff. And that's why we need to talk about it when we're sitting at the gate, when we're walking by the way, when we're rising up. And,
that's right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hey, Kevin.
So just thinking in terms of, you know, you mentioned about birds being analogous to angels / demons, depending on their inclination.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and we also see kind of that happening with the stars as well. And but we see that the sun, moon, and the stars are part of the creation account.
Yep.
And so, like, what in terms of what are your thoughts on the pre-Adam existence of sun, moon, and stars, or did the earth, was it just sitting there?
I don't know. It's a good question. It's very interesting that, like, God creates light, but then he actually creates sun, moon, and stars on the fourth day. Mm-hmm. Creates the light on the first day. So the light's just kind of, where is it? Well, it's just there.
Well, you also made, jumped out of me, you also made reference to, like, speed of light, makes reference to time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, that there be light, time, stretching. I'm just stretching here a little bit. I would say somehow it's connected.
Well,
maybe?
Time came, I think, when the planets came, because everything about time is based on rotation of the moon around the earth and the earth around the sun.
That's
so
true.
Until the planets start moving, there's really no such thing
sense
as time.
Of, no measurement of time.
Right, yeah, there's no means to measure it. Yeah. Right. So
The account in Genesis 1-2, you can read it on a number of levels. Reading about the as six literal days in the seventh day, which I agree with, but also as epochs of 1,000 years, and in each one he's doing stuff. I don't understand the whole light and loop, then basically the sun, moon, and stars are holders of the light, but the light exists beforehand. Perhaps at the very least that light is Yeshua. The Jews have the Kabbalists have a concept called the Or HaGanuz, the hidden light. And when I see them talking about it, I go, I know who you're talking about. You're talking about Yeshua. You can't see it, can you? And no, they can't. But we can. So are we of a higher order than they? And I would say yes. But there's going to be a time when they can see. And the full complement of Jews are part of the Church of the Firstborn and all the rest of it. But where those luminaries fit in, I don't know.
Well, you had a good... This is my segue to my other question. Because he just said it, so I want to capitalize on it. So, you have in your other talk that the next step is a regathering of the 10 tribes or Ephraim into Eretz Zaphon, the land of the north.
As I understand it.
Right. And then but simultaneously to that, or concurrently with that, you would have Eleazar the priest being raised from the dead. In other words, the Levitical priesthood for Judah in the land.
Yeah, I think that God's going to raise up the priesthood, but I'm not sure. It seems to be when Yeshua brings Ephraim to the wilderness in Leviticus. Sorry, in John chapter 11,
mm-hmm.
And that as soon as I read that, I go, wilderness of the people. It says that in the scriptures, I'll bring them to the wilderness of the people. And I go, so, okay, so when does that happen? I think that, as I understand it, the reconciliation between the two houses is going to require, it's going to happen after they're, once they're in the north country.
Right.
Does Yeshua send... Do we go to the wilderness of the people before we get to the north country, or do we go after we've gone to the north country? I still have to check that out. But if I know that, then I can know when Judah is reconciled through Lazarus, because he sent Lazarus to Judah
right.
first before he goes to the wilderness of the people. I imagine that it's still a way off yet, right, but I may be wrong.
And I'd
rather be wrong.
But I guess what I'm thinking is right, if we are regathered to the north ahead of that, which stands to reason.
Yeah.
Because if Judah is going to join Ephraim in the north country to be reconciled, then Ephraim has to already be in the north country, which means Judah is not in the north country, which to me means Judah would be in the land.
Yes.
And if Judah's in the land, is Eleazar the priest going to be raised from the dead, so to speak, and they would have their sacrifices going and have the temple up in operation during that time?
And while we're
up in the north, will Judah be doing its thing in the south?
That's a good question. I know they're pushing to get this temple, but of course they reject the cornerstone, don't they? Mm-hmm. And the Masons and the Mormons and all that will be very keen to help them out. And the Holy Mother of Harlots, you know, the Catholic Church, she'll be happy. Because as long as they deny Yeshua, because I mean the core of Catholicism is now really entrenched in idol worship.
But I could see where they could make a new menorah. I could see where they could make brazen altar, labor. I could see where they could have an altar of the incense, and I could see the table of the showbread, and they could have the best tasting bread in the Holy Land brought up there every week for Shabbat. How are they going to do that without the Ark of the Covenant?
I don't know that the Ark of the Covenant is actually necessary for the operation of the temple, because they had a temple operating without it in the past.
Okay. 190 Ministries just endorsed a video release yesterday for the people who are out, who followed and unveiled with couples the cover scroll, to be able to go, and they've pretty much found and did some mineral testing and all this, and there's actually some concrete sealed up over the cave. So now more than ever is there an idea that they found the Ark of the Covenant.
Okay.
So just interesting. 190 Ministry says, let's gather together and pray for this to be released. So.
Well, I guess your point is that the Ark of the Covenant may not be required, because it does say that the Antichrist or the Holy, he stands in the holy place. It doesn't say in the Holy of Holies.
That's right.
So
that's right.
He stands there where the menorah and the showbread
right.
is.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly good. Right. That's something that stood out to me too. So doesn't say Kadosh Kadoshim. It doesn't say Holy of Holies. It just says right. Holy place. So I assume that's just, you know, where you say, yeah.
And where I'm going with all this is I'm trying to reconcile in my head what is going to be the relationship for the next phase of this between Judah and Ephraim.
You know, I personally think we've got a bit of history to get through before we get to that bit.
Yeah.
I think we've got to get out of the United States and Australia. And I'm not saying all of the Lost Tribes are going to the North Country, because they're also brought in from other places. But there's going to be a lot of the Lost Tribes brought to this North Country. As I understand that, that's around the area basically where Laban was, right. Up around that area.
Like
where Jacob got his brides from, and
Eliezer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he went to Rebecca. Yeah, same area. So same area.
And you just that's good.
No, it's not Samaria actually. So I've got a picture of that one on another slide. I can bring that up for other people while you're talking about that. Was there another question there?
Yeah, Giselle had one.
Yeah, far away.
Well, I had one, but now I have two after I
All right.
Do you have two more? Okay.
And they're not questions, they're statements.
All right, well, that's even better. That means I don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were talking about the heavenly bodies. How could there be light without the heavenly bodies?
Yeah, that's right. Yep, okay. The sun, moon, and stars.
Right.
Not talking about the supernova.
Right. When you consider that the word light could also mean good, goodness.
Yep.
Something that's light,
carry on. Yeah.
The opposite of that would be dark, meaning evil.
Yep.
That has nothing to do with with sun, moon, and stars. But
Say that again. I just was multitasking. I can't multitask. Last sentence.
And I'm not speaking. I have these thoughts in my head, but I don't always verbalize them well. Okay, so if light came before the heavenly bodies that reflect light.
Yeah, that's right. That hold the light.
Well, some of them are inherently light.
Such
as the sun.
Yeah.
But the moon without the sun would not be reflecting. It would not be a luminary body.
Yeah.
Because it's not luminescent.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is he made the light, meaning that he made the aspect of being good, something that is good, and the dark, meaning
the bad
or the evil.
That's the way I tend to look at that whole stuff. I don't get wrapped up too much in the physical. When I'm actually reading it, I'm kind of going straight to a woman's mind, I must admit. I go, this isn't just talking about mechanics. It's actually talking about relationship, and it's actually talking about the sun, moon, and stars represents Jacob and his mother, you know, Joseph's dream.
Joseph, yeah.
Yeah, so I automatically think of the holders of the light being the good guys and the Choshech being the bad guys, the darkness being the bad guys. When I look at the darkness was upon the face of the deep, well, the face is the deep that's related to something bad. Okay. So, when I read it, I don't get too wound up in the physical side of things. I'm automatically thinking about, because God's all about relationship. He's not about, when you read the Bible, it's a book about relationships. It's not actually a book about, you know, how to build the universe. Although I bet you it's all in you actually, but it doesn't seem to be that he's actually talking in terms of cookie cutter how to build the solar system. He seems to be talking about much more than that, and that's the bit that I kind of plug into. And so I don't give it a whole. I just have a big question mark. How did the light get from day one and cross over to day four? You know, what was going on in the middle, and how do you know a day and a night if you don't have a sun, moon, and stars to orchestrate it all? And I just put all that in the too hard basket while I think about other things at the moment. But it's a good question, because I bet you there's a logical explanation for it. Right?
So when Yeshua says, I am the light of the world, he's the goodness of the world.
Yes.
He's not necessarily the light coming from this light bulb above my head.
No, that's right. And I think that's what, as I said, the rabbis have the concept of the hidden light. And it's only hidden to the darkness. The light shineth in the darkness, but the darkness, Choshech, didn't comprehend it. Tell some people the gospel, they tell the truth, and of course, we don't know who the darkness is. Some people are just asleep.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, and God wakes them up in their time. But other people are the darkness, and you can share if the cows come home, but they'll never get it.
Yeah.
So darkness has a face. It has many faces, and they're in this world. They're of the darkness. They're cut off from the light, but we can receive it. So here, the sun, moon, and stars are right down here, you could say. I'm just being metaphorical. And the darkness is down here. This world, even though it's light, and there's light coming off the screen, this world is a world of darkness. And we're the light, and Yeshua is that light within us. So he's that hidden light that was created in day one, if you like. And we are the holders of the light, the sun, moon, and stars, so to speak. We're the stars of the sky for multitude. We're the sons of the living God. And we are the ones that are the luminaries. And that big thing up there is just the whole big universe. It's there to populate and just, I'd love to have a spaceship and zoom around in this, but that's just there. That's just an outward expression of what is going down here. I mean, that's the way I tend to think about things a little bit. So I tend to think that maybe the sun, moon, and stars are us, you know, in some respects, and the darkness is the face of the deep. It's the bad guys that just can't get it. And because that they're not meant to get it. So I still can't answer the question about the physical universe, but I think I can understand it about the spiritual universe.
Well, like I said, I was making a statement in answer to your question about the light.
Well, it's interesting that when God next in part of Genesis, where he talks about sun, moon, and stars, he's talking about mum, dad, and the kids. He's not talking about building solar systems, as I said. You know, so it's obvious to me. Even the language, the face of the deep, the face of the waters, the face of this and face of that. It's all people. It's anthropomorphic.
When you think about the deep, the deepest part of deep would be like the abyss, which would hold the darkness, the most evil that there could be.
That's right. I also think there's an interesting place in the Book of Ruth that talks about the whole city was kind of a buzz when Ruth came or something or other. I can't remember the context exactly, but it's the same word related to the word Tahom. There's a little bit of a link there. I can't quite remember the exact connection I made. I wrote a little article about it and I've forgotten my own article. But when I read about Tahom and I think about the little bit I know about physics, which is not a lot, it's not the maths of the physics, it's just the description of chaos or when you go down into the quantum level, it's very chaotic. The universe is kind of bubbling and broiling, if you like. It's chaotic. And I think when it talks about the deep, if I'm looking at things in a physical, physics sort of point of view, I can actually see Tahom or the deep in that chaos that underpins all of reality. And I think that's also in some strange way related to the Holy Spirit that actually holds this whole universe, is the substrate on which this whole universe is. See, the Lord spoke the universe into being, but the Spirit of God is kind of hovering beforehand, if you like. So you can read about the Spirit hovering upon the waters in a whole other way, that the waters are kind of related to that substrate that underpins all of reality, and that God's Word is the order that vibrating thing is the canvas, but the Word is the actual is drawing. But you have to have a canvas there before the pencil can do something. So, yeah. I think that physics is really starting to get to the point where we can start to understand perhaps the book of Genesis chapter 1 in a physical way. And although we looked at, you know, 100 years ago, if you compare Genesis with what scientists knew about reality, they just go, ha ha ha, laugh. But, you know, physics is getting stranger and stranger. You know, quantum theory, string theory, and the little that I can see what scientists are trying to explain, I keep making connections with Genesis and with Yeshua as being the living word, the vibrating string that holds all of reality together. I think that we'll probably understand Genesis a lot more as we go, because the end is in the beginning. Bereshit is in Achrit, or Achrit is in. So as we come to the last days, Achrit, as we come to the end, we'll begin to understand Genesis more and more. And then from that, we'll begin to understand where we're living in. Because we're kind of like the Tav, we're coming back to the Aleph, or the Aleph coming back to the Tav, you know. If you draw the Hebrew letters, I've got there's a neat website called BibleWheel.com, and unfortunately the author of it lost his faith. And because all he had was letters and numbers, and he didn't have... He lost his faith. You can have a whole lot of information.
Who was that, by the way?
Can't remember his name. It's from someplace in America.
I remember looking at the website up though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very familiar sounding.
He possessed the real beer,
and he had some wonderful insights. And there's 66 books in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, and that goes into 22 three concentric rings of 22, and there just seems to be 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and there's 22 chapters in the book of Revelation, and Yeshua calls himself the Alpha and Omega, but in Hebrew it's Aleph and Tav. Mm-hmm. And he announces that, and it's in Revelation chapter 1 and Revelation 22 that he says he's the first and the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, or the first and last. He's the Aleph and the Tav. Tav being the 22 letter. So we've got this 22, 22, 22, 22 thing going on. We have right here Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet, and you read it across there, and you come back to Tav. And so Aleph and Tav are kind of joined. And so the end is in the beginning. We're going kind of full circle. So if we want to understand Tav, just get to know Aleph. If you want to know what's happening right at the end, just get to know the beginning.
That's so interesting, the Milky Way and the whole thing with David Flynn. You got the snake, the serpent with the tongue, and
Ouroboros.
Come back and follow.
And that's all true. Yeah. That's interesting too. Like it says that the Satan. It says that the Tan was created on the fifth day. It says the great whale, but it doesn't say that in Hebrew. It says the Tan, the Tan, the Leviathan, the Tan, the dragon. So man was made on the sixth day. But he was made in the fifth day. Leviathan, there's actually five letters in it. Leviathan, there's 5 points on a pentagram. The goat's head, it's all about him. By the way, goat and dragon, what is Levi? Levi's the goat and the priesthood is the dragon. So that's, he seems to be something that was like some sort of corrupted Levite. Guardian cherub. He was like the sons of Korah. Satan was like the son of Lucifer. Was like the sons of Korah, the singers and the priests combined, because he had both. He was a musician, rock star in the heavens, basically, and he was a priest as well. So it was all about knowledge. It says, "Seek knowledge from the priest's mouth." So someone that's from Levi should be somebody that gives knowledge. But there's a dragon-like thing, nature in there. And you see that even Jacob was afraid of their anger. And he cursed their anger. So he cursed be Simeon and Levi because their anger is fierce. And there's implications of Levi and Simeon being involved with instigating Joseph's betrayal. And it was the Levitical priesthood that condemned Yeshua. Okay. But yet many Levite priests turned to him, and it was a Levitical priest named John the Baptist that announced him. So it wasn't all bad guys. A lot of the good priests had kind of got out of Jerusalem because it had become so corrupt. And they were living with they were the Essenes. They were living, in the Judean hills and elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, but there's a whole, goes on and on.
Teresa's
question.
Oh, wait, that's a good segue, because I was in Ezekiel where it talks about that every precious stone was his covering.
Yeah.
So was that his breastplate?
Yeah, it was his caution plate. He was a priest.
Okay, so was he part of, before he fell, was he part of the Melchizedek priesthood?
Well, he was part of, he was certainly called Leviathan. Leviathan.
That would have been the
Levi dragon.
Levitical priesthood?
Yes. I believe he's some sort of Levitical priest, but not of the same order as we're familiar with.
Okay. And so with that, does that tie into the scripture in 2 Corinthians where it says, we speak of a wisdom among those who are mature, a wisdom, however, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away, but we speak of God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God predestined before the ages of our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory.
Yeah, I think of those rulers as not just being, yes, it's earthly, but more particularly, it's the heavenly rulers.
So that's what I said. Does that
that's the way in? I read it, because, you know, sorry?
Does that tie into the lamb slain before the foundation?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how, you see, that's before the foundation of the world, so that's even before the stuff that was before Adam.
Right.
You know, the stuff that was before Adam was just another cycle of maybe 7,000 years that was happening on Earth, you know, and it culminated in the Earth being tohu vavohu, and all the birds of the heaven have fled. There was no Adam, there was no Adam, there was no man on the earth. And it's related to a desolation that happened to Israel, and the fact that the judgment of Israel now is related to then. But the lamb being slain before the foundation of the earth, maybe even before that. So I haven't pieced it all together. All that I've found is there's some stuff that's going on that's outside of our 7,000 or 6,000 years since Adam. So I'm not quite sure of where everything slots in there. Certainly Lucifer fell and became Satan, the accuser, before. And he was the Tarn, or dragon, was created on the fifth day. So does that mean in a previous cycle of 7,000 years before Adam, that on the fifth day of that cycle that Satan fell and became the dragon, the Tarn? I don't know. I'm just.
I want to draw attention to Teresa. He has on his website an article that was very interesting around showing which stones it mentions of in the breastplate of Lucifer. I don't know if you ever heard that before, but it's very interesting because it represents that some of the stones that are missing from his are those that are actually binding him from having any authority over. So one of them is, again, I think it has to do with giving life.
Yep.
One of them is to be able to be the thing that's lifted up so he could never acquire the authority of Yeshua. Is bound in his structure, his concentrate of who he is, so his breastplate that represents the stones are 9 instead of 12, so 3 that are missing are the 3 that actually are given to Israel. It's really interesting. You got to share the link with people because it's really, really, really good.
Yeah, there's obviously something important. 9 represents fertility. Chapter 9 is related to the fruits of spirit. So Satan is all about fertility, and in fact that's the whole goat thing, and the whole she male sort of goat Baphomet thing. Mm-hmm. Fertility. So 9's about fertility, but 12's about government, human government, and angelic government. So we have 12 tribes, we have the 12 stones. So it's about government. It's something that Satan aspired to. He wanted that, but he can't have it. But it seems that the woman with the 12 stars about her head is related to that government that he aspired to. You remember Haman and Esther. Esther's a picture of the church. Esther means I will hide. I mean, Esther is actually it's just a transliteration of Astarte in with Hebrew letters. Her name was Hadassah, Myrtle, but it was changed to Esther. But it just so happens that Esther, when spelt with those Hebrew letters, happens to mean I will hide. And in the book of Esther, God's name is not mentioned once. God is working in the background. Wow. But that whole picture of Esther and in the court, that court is the heavenly court. And Haman, I believe, represents he's an Amalek. He's an Agagite, which was from Amalek. King Agag was from Amalek. But and Amalek is serpent, but more particularly Haman. Remember the manna?
Yeah.
That's called Haman as well. Mm-hmm. So Haman represents one species. The manna represents the species. Haman means the species. So Yeshua is that species, but Haman is the other species, the other seed. So Haman represents the seed of the serpent. He represents the dragon. So the dragon goes and he wants to kill the Jews. He wants to kill the Jews, but he can't because Esther, which represents, I believe, Zion and the church, which is the same thing. She, the king's in love with her. Well, no, she's on good terms with the king. And, she's able to get his ear. There's going to come a time when the church has made herself ready. She'll just say to the king what she wants, and the king will say, yeah, because she's doing everything he wants her to. And then the dragon is cast out of heaven, and that's what happens to Haman. He's at her bedside, and then the king comes in and says, what, you want to take even, that? And so, my wife sort of thing, and then he's undone. And so that whole courtroom drama is actually a picture of the heavenly court. And then the 10 sons are killed. Mm-hmm. 10 sons of Haman. Then there's the dragon with 10 heads, 7 heads and 10 horns. Okay, I can't help but make connections, you know. So, yeah. forgot what the point there was, but
yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, the Bible is just one book. It's all Torah. It's all interconnected. You're reading the Psalms, you're reading the Torah. You're reading the book of 2 Corinthians, you're reading the Torah. One thing about the New Testament is it's a lot more intimate. And those are love letters, the epistles. And it's obviously dealing with Israel at a higher level.